What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Zero Foxtrot isn't just a brand, it's a way of life. Founded and operated by veterans, Zero Foxtrot's unique apparel and gear echoes the grit of the warrior culture. Zero Foxtrot dedicates itself to producing content, honoring the sacrifices of forgotten heroes of the past, and connecting history to the present. Embark on a journey with Zero Foxtrot today at ZeroFoxtrot.com. It's not merely our products. It's about the ethos that we embody. Rugged, resilient, and timeless.
You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins.
Hello, good humans. Welcome to an episode of this podcast in which we talk about independent music, whether it's punk, hardcore, emo, indie rock, metal, whatever it is. That is what we address. And we talk to the people who are creating it, making it up as they go, like all of us, documenting it, all of those things, because we care about this scene tremendously. I have what I would like to call a legendary human being within the scene on the show today, and that is none other than Dan Yemin, who played in Lifetime, Kid Dynamite, is the vocalist for Paint It Black, and he also plays in a band called Open City. And a few key things to note. First of all, Open City, his band, is releasing a new record on October 6th called Hands in the Honey Jar. It's on Get Better Records, and they have a few singles streaming up now. You should check them out because Open City is really, really, really good. Members of Bridge and Tunnel as well, and it's just people who are very, very comfortable in playing music, and it sounds like it, and it shows, and it's awesome. And for those that have not been paying attention, Paint It Black also announced a new record on Revelation, and that is coming out November 3rd. And I was incredibly excited. Dan told me about that off mic when we weren't recording, and I was like, wow, new Paint It Black. This is exciting. So Dan has a lot of stuff going on, which is great. And before we dive into the discussion with him, let's talk about how you can get in touch with the show. You can always email me at 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. I love to receive feedback and just ideas, whatever it is that's on your mind, down to talk about it. I also want you, I plead with you, to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That helps out the show tremendously. I know you hear it all the time if you listen to the show on a week-to-week basis, but not everybody does. And you know, for the one time that I don't mention it, it might hit a person where they might do it, so you get it. But rating and review there, you can leave a rating on the Spotify page in which you listen to this podcast. All of those things help out tremendously, and I greatly, greatly do appreciate that. Been able to hit a few shows recently, which I am excited to discuss here. Just last night, I saw the Scowl Military Gun MS Paint Tour here in the Southern California area. It's, man, it's exciting to see packed out shows and all bands firing on all cylinders. I'd never seen MS Paint before. Very enjoyable. Scowl, I've actually never seen in California. I haven't. I've only seen them internationally, and it was really cool to see a home state reaction, not hometown reaction. And Military Gun is super, super fun. I always enjoy seeing them, so it was a great show, and it definitely felt like there was a whole new batch of kids coming to the shows, which is great. That's what you want in this beautiful scene of ours. I also went to see Teenage Wrist in Spiritual Cramp and Initiate play again, just about 10 minutes from my house. It was, oh, I love it when shows are close. It's nice and convenient. but got to watch those bands play. And Spiritual Cramp, man, I love that band. It was probably about a year and a half since I saw them last. And yeah, they're cooking, man. So catch either of those tours if they come through your town, because yeah, you just won't be disappointed. And for those of you that have been kind to reach out, have noticed a little raspiness in my voice. I got something going on. I don't know what it is, so I'm going to visit the doctor later on this month. So yeah, appreciate that. But hopefully it's not too annoying. It just kind of feels like I got a little scratch in my throat, so to speak. And not really necessarily sickness, just kind of like a hoarse throat. So anyways, weird stuff. But if you have an inclination of something going on in your body, go to the doctor. I can't tell you how many people are just like, oh yeah, I'll just like put my head down and tough it out. That's not a good vibe. Trust me. So anyways, like I said, Dan Yemen is on the show. I respect him and his guitar playing greatly. He is an intense dude in a good way. Like, he's very focused, and I felt very listened to as I asked these questions. And there were many times where he paused for, you know, a good 10 seconds or so to kind of collect himself, think about a response. And I appreciate that. So I leave those in because I don't want this to, you know, seem like it's, you know, just editing out those pauses or whatever. To me, that makes the conversation, you know, just it gives you the context for it. So anyways, here's Dan Yemen from Open City, Lifetime, Paint It Black, Kid Dynamite, all of those awesome things. So here he is. Being a person in their early 40s, I have felt like I've grown up in watching your bands. And I mean, I definitely did not see Lifetime, unfortunately, in the early iteration. Definitely saw you guys once you played, you know, the reunion shows and everything like that. But it feels like we are ostensibly watching you grow up musically, which obviously many of us have. And this may be playing a little, you know, armchair psychologist in a way, but the, you know, something that you probably are like, don't do that, Ray, because you're not a professional. You're for
it. I don't mind switching seats. I'm here for that.
Yeah. So it seems like the roles that you have filled in, you know, a lot of your bands, if not all, is like you've been, for lack of a better term, like the dad in the band, where it's been like, you know, maybe the most responsible person, maybe the person that's, you know, doing show booking or, you know, settling up at the end of the night. Again, that's just maybe on the outside looking in, the impression that I get. Is that correct in any way, shape, or form?
For better or for worse, it was the case for a long time, and it is not the case anymore, which is great.
Got it.
Because I wouldn't wish that job on anyone. It's actually a really good psychological question, because like how people end up driving the bus, metaphorically speaking, in a band, and how isolating that is for that person within the band, is actually like a really interesting, it's painful for me but it's interesting.
Right. Well, and that's the, I mean, the reason I bring that up is the idea that usually, I mean, especially in punk and hardcore bands, when obviously most of us are children and have no idea what we're doing, a lot of that, those tasks end up falling on the singer's lap, for better or worse, just because it's like, oh yeah, they're the person out there kind of talking to everybody or whatever. But it seems like, you know, for a lot of the stuff that you've been involved in, you maybe either had that, not mindset, but you had that air of being like, oh yes, like I can kind of handle this, even though, you know, I don't necessarily know what I'm doing. I'm still trying to figure it out. So that's the reason that's why I found it interesting, where it was like, it seemed like you were the guy that was, you know, kind of pushing things forward, so to speak, from the business aspect of the band.
So I'm trying to figure out the way that that was long and it was a really good question, but I'm trying to figure out actually which part of it is the question.
No, it's I tend to ramble on, and I appreciate you trying to.
It's all right. So do I. I just realized I was sitting there like on the edge of a cliff going, wait, what am I answering?
No, for sure. Basically, just say like, did you enjoy that? I mean, like you said, you did not necessarily like the fact that it fell in your laps, but did you enjoy certain aspects of the kind of business of the band, as it were?
I did not enjoy it in Lifetime at all.
Got it. It
isolated me okay. In a way that was really painful and frustrating. And you know, when we started, I was 22 and the other guys were 18 and 19. And that's at that age, that's a vast difference. And so, you know, I was actually just talking to somebody about this the other day, because we were talking about the very first tour we did, which was Lifetime and Resurrection, 10 dudes in one cargo van. And sometimes there are like sort of structural forces that create the dad role or the parent role in a band. So it's our first tour, and we did not own a van yet. And at that time, you could like budget rent a car was part of had been folded into Sears, and they would rent a cargo van, which basically just a normal size van with two front seats and the rest of it's empty. And they would rent it by a flat rate by the week, unlimited mileage. But you had to have a credit card, and I was the only one with a credit card.
Okay.
Which meant that I was the one worried about whether we were going to have enough money at the end of the month for me to pay that bill. And also the one kind of making sure nobody like messed up the van.
Yep.
I tell you that nobody else cared about. and that was like, so to be the one to be 22 and have to be like reeling people in and like, you know, I didn't want to be the one to tell people not to shoot off bottle rockets in the van.
Right.
Like, that's not a fun job.
Definitely not.
but that was my job by virtue of the fact that my name was on the rental agreement.
Yep. Of course.
So yeah, I wouldn't, in that sense, it was not fun and it was lonely. When I was sort of the band parent in with regard to sort of the vision of the band later on, like in Kid Dynamite, I enjoyed it, but then I also learned some hard lessons, which is that like controlling everything is not healthy.
Sure.
Yeah, so and now I stay out of the role of band parent.
Right. Yeah. It's nice to be able to, relinquish that control and understand that. I mean, especially too, I'm sure now where you are at there, the pressure to play in a band is only the pressure of your own desire, as opposed to, oh, we got to put out another record because we got a tour for the next 180 days or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Which we'll get into a little bit later, but, you as a person, I know, correct me if I'm wrong, were you actually born and raised in New Jersey or where did you come from?
A bunch of different places. Born in New York, raised in, let's see, upstate New York, like near Schenectady, then Yonkers, then northern New Jersey. And then, so I came of age in New Jersey, like 8 to 18. I lived there. And then I went to school in Michigan. And then I went back to New Jersey for a couple of years and then moved to Philadelphia for school. and have been there ever since 92.
Got it. And so like when you were, you know, like going into whatever junior high and high school and everything like that and developing some of your, you know, what you would call an identity, what was your, I guess, family structure like, brothers and sisters in the house? Like what did that look like?
I have a younger brother, 2 years younger than me.
Got it. And mom and dad in the house?
Yes.
So kind of a, you know, quote unquote, typical upbringing in regards to the, you know, nuclear family, as it were.
Yeah, definitely.
And your exposure, I know, to like punk and hardcore was definitely introduced via skateboarding, or did it come in any other direction?
Oh, no, I was smart enough not to spend much time on the skateboard. I'm not athletic at all. I would have broken so many bones. I could like get down the street on a skateboard, but no. My introduction to punk and hardcore was through, I guess other kids around me who had older siblings.
Okay.
You know, cool older sibling syndrome. And then college radio. So specifically, the Rutgers radio station, WRSU, and a station that does not, as far as I can tell, exist anymore, WSIA, which was Staten Island College. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that was like, you know, I got turned on to like British punk through friends that were like, you know, into music, who had older brothers who were into cool stuff. So Clash, Sex Pistols, probably Minor Threat, that route. And then the rest was just like, with that as a conduit, like college radio, and then like buying stuff that looked weird at the record store in our town.
Mm-hmm. And what, like, as you started to become interested in this, and I'm guessing that your parents and or younger sibling did not have any exposure besides you to this stuff. Yeah. Did they treat that as kind of like a, what is Dan getting into? This is very bizarre. Or were they generally permissive for you to, you know, kind of explore the stuff you were exploring?
They were permissive. And not in the sense of like no rules, but like, you know, as long as I wasn't like hurting anybody or like screwing up badly in school, it wasn't, you know, they weren't really concerned with what I was getting into. And they let, you know, from a pretty young age, they let me go into the city with friends, like on the train and stuff. So, I was free to explore in that way.
Yeah.
But you know, to them, in my house, there was only classical music. So, the Sex Pistols might as well have been Led Zeppelin. Like they had no idea.
Right.
They had no idea it was any weirder than like Aerosmith.
Sure. Right. And anything that was, you know, included guitar, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is so beyond the pale.
Yeah. They just didn't understand it, but they weren't. I mean, I also think they didn't imagine they were supposed to understand it. They weren't those kind of people.
Right. Right. Was there any, notion of you continuing on in regards to maybe your life path as far as a career to follow in your parents' footsteps, whatever they did?
No.
It was never being like, all right, you're going to take up the family trade, whatever that may mean.
No, they're just like, they wanted us to be led by our curiosity and just like find something that was like exciting for us.
Which is cool, because I think that, I mean, especially of that generation of the, you know, whatever, the boomers, whatever you want to broadly describe that as, sometimes it was that idea that, oh man,
they're just a little pre-boomer, my parents.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
they were born in, my dad was born in 1933 and my mom in 1941.
Got it. But it's cool that you were given that experience to, you know, follow your passions, because sometimes that was not, you know, even part of the vernacular of what parents even knew what to do. It's like, well, yeah, you got to go to this and do this, and that's what you do.
Yeah, I think as long as we took education seriously, they stayed out of our way.
Yeah.
I think there was a little bit of noise as we got a little older that, like, maybe my mom was anxious that some paths, you know, would be difficult financially. But that also got squashed pretty quickly.
Sure.
Because by the time I heard any of that, my brother and I were both in school and we're both in college. And we're both like, you do not, that is not a thing you can say. That's like not, I won't get into the specifics because I don't want to throw my mom under the bus, but I'm just like, you're kidding me. Like, you've encouraged us our whole lives to just like follow our curiosity. And like, now when we're like 19 and 21, you said this thing like, about, you know, we're just like, no, that's not
right.
That's not how this conversation goes. And thanks. You know, my parents are pretty receptive. Like there wasn't a lot of pushback after that. I think.
Yeah.
I think my mom realized pretty quick that she was being hypocritical, basically.
Which, I mean, you have the ability, like you said, you know, once you are ostensibly an adult and able to have that sort of pushback conversation, you know, in a, you know, gentle and or forceful way to be like, oh yeah, like you can't do this. And then all of a sudden do that. And it's like, oh yeah, well, man, yeah, a good point.
Yeah. Like, what are you changing course? This is like, and ultimately now I would probably like, then I was like 21. I was like, so punk. So I was like, you know, my response would be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Right. In retrospect, I would probably say like, this is really confusing in light of what you've told us our whole lives.
Right. There may have been a more measured response at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I think my parents in general were, the way they raised us was in a lot of ways a reaction to their awareness that they were like, too under their parents' umbrellas as young adults. Right. You know, their path, which was not uncommon at the time, given like sort of like where they're from and what sort of what the economy was like. They're both raised in the Bronx. They both went to college in New York and lived at home. And then didn't get out from under their parents until they both went to grad school in the Midwest, independent of each other. They didn't know each other at that point. And I think they kind of came to this realization in their like later 20s that like more independence earlier would have been good for them.
Sure. And they were able to apply that lesson, whatever that may mean, towards you guys.
Yeah. And their philosophy was basically like, raise trustworthy kids and then trust them.
Our friends at Rockabilia.com want you to know that you can get 10% off of your entire order if you go to their site, Rockabilia.com, and use the promo code 100 words or less. And what does that mean to you? Well, obviously, it means a discount. It's free money for you as you are placing all of these orders for, you know, maybe gifts for friends and family. Maybe you want a, you know, really sick Grateful Dead shirt for yourself or whatever, or maybe you are in the market for something for your dad or your mom or your brother or your sister, whatever it is. Rockabilia has all of the officially licensed stuff that you can shake a stick at. And they have like, I don't know, 500,000 items for you to browse around and check out. And it ships from the Midwest here in the United States of America. And it gets to you lickety-split. And on top of it, they have amazing customer service if you run into any problems. And they got great people working for them. I love this company so much. And you've heard me talk about them like a million times. But now, today is the day in which you go to rockabilia.com, use the promo code 100 words or less, buy a bunch of stuff, and you will reap the benefits. So there we go. 100 words or less is the promo code, 10% off your order. Thank you very much, rockabilia.com.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day. Whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade, at The Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97, for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at HomeDepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See HomeDepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
It seems like you lived in, you know, a pretty intellectually curious house, and like you said, education was definitely an important part of it. Did school come easy to you, or did you have to, you know, work relatively hard to, you know, get the grades that would allow you to go to shows in the city and stuff like that?
It came easily to me up until the years where, like, there was a lot more homework, and then I had a lot of trouble sort of focusing.
Sure. And were you drawn?
And then I had to figure out how to, like, work hard.
Sure. And were you drawn to the fact that, like, I mean, it sounded like there was no other path for you in regards to, like, oh yes, of course you could go to college. And I know that you went to University of Michigan, and, you know, you pursued, the, you know, academic route in ways that maybe other people didn't, especially when they started to get involved with punk and hardcore, where it's like, oh yeah, I'm just going to go on tour for the rest of my life. And it's like, well, that's not that practical.
And we're really privileged that they had the resources to send us to college. So, like,
sure.
I was appreciative of that. I also wasn't in band when I started college. So, like, going on tour was not really, like, I couldn't even have imagined that when I was 18.
Right. That wasn't even part of the radar. Sure.
Yeah.
And when you started to, you know, go to shows and experience that right in front of your face, did you immediately want to play in bands and kind of participate in that way? Or was that something you had to work your way up to?
I mean, I was in bands, like, in my town, but, like, it still seemed like the people on stage at CBGB seemed in another universe still. Even though there was no, you know, even though they were 2 feet in front of me, the idea that I could do that was still pretty far away.
Sure. That there was not a real easy thing, well, not easy, but that there was a path for you to be able to exist on a stage like CBGB's at some point.
Yeah. Like, I was in a band in high school with friends, and we played a mix of covers, and I think our originals probably sounded like the early, like, the Jam, like All Mod Cons era Jam or something like that. At least okay. that's what we were going for. But, like, the idea that we could play outside of, like, a school gymnasium in our town was not something that occurred to me.
Sure. And kind of putting the focus on, Lifetime in particular, watching the band's evolution sonically, like, I mean, I know once I got into you guys, it was definitely around the Hello Bastards time. And then, you know, being able to listen to the records that came after it, and then obviously the stuff that came before that, it was so interesting to be able to see how you guys took steps forward. And from what I can kind of gather, and you can obviously correct me if I'm wrong, like, as, you know, Lifetime started, whatever, the New Age era versus the Jade Tree era, a lot of people were, you know, understood you were a hardcore band, but at the same time, like, you brought a lot of melodic sensibilities to it.
Right.
Were a lot of people kind of being like, what the hell are these guys doing? Like, I don't really understand it. Or was it kind of like, okay, that's what I thought.
People had no idea what to make of us a lot of times, especially because Ari wanted to sing. Like, my vision, like, of where I thought we could sort of land or hoped we could land when we started out was more like Turning Point or something like that. It was like really melodic, but the vocals were still screamed. But Ari was like, that was cool, like in terms of instrumentation, but he was like more like All or the Descendants or something in terms of what he wanted to execute vocally. So right. he didn't want to scream. And so there was a lot, by the time we started, there was a nice precedent for melodic hardcore punk, you know, like Dag Nasty, Verbal Assault, Gorilla Biscuits, Turning Point. But like a hardcore band that sang, and then, you know, there was like punk stuff that had straight singing, like Descendants and All. But like a hardcore band where the singer just sang, there wasn't much of a precedent for that. Maybe Reason to Believe.
Sure.
And, you know, bands that really weren't particularly well known outside their region. There was a band from Florida called Quit. I have their LP. And they were kind of like a one and done thing around for a couple of years. And they played fast music with like sung vocals, but.
Right.
People really didn't know where to place us. And people want categories, you know?
Yep. And
I remember when Fucked Up put their first album out on J-Tree, listening to people like grown adults in their 30s, like expend a lot of energy debating whether it was a hardcore record or a street punk record, you know? So like, and those are like men in their 30s. So like, imagine like people love categories, you know, and they don't know, they kind of, I think, rely on categories to even like sometimes make sense of what they're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine what like a bunch of like 17 to 20 year olds in suburban New Jersey in 1990, you know, were trying to make sense of us. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm guessing there, you know, once you did release more music and, you know, the Hello Bastards and, you know, Jersey Spence Best Dancers era, it seemed like people at least then were able to understand the direction that you were heading and kind of where you guys were coming from.
I think they had to re-understand it because they started, you know, we did the 7-inch and then the album, and like people were starting to sort of have a way to think about what we were doing. And then we kind of pivoted,
mm-hmm.
Which to me is just a natural progression. I mean, we were all over the place and we didn't know what we wanted to be. You know, I was like, influenced by like Turning Point, Verbal Assault, Dag Nasty, all, but also like Burn and stuff like that. And like everybody was influenced by Quicksand in New Jersey in 1991.
Sure.
So our influences were all over the place. And I think it was when we sort of like got comfortable with each other and each other's abilities, we're able to sort of be like, oh, you know what, the fundamentals, like 7 seconds of Minor Threat, are like all we really need as like influence.
Right.
And so it's kind of like a more like a hard reset. Like, oh yeah, like we're just like the classics, you know, like we know our limitations and we just kind of reset and we're trying to grounded ourselves back in the classics.
Sure.
Instead of trying to figure out this amalgam of sort of groundbreaking melodic hardcore bands that we couldn't decide which one was a better path to follow. All sounded a little bit different. We just were like, right. The crew.
Yeah. Yeah, that works. That's what we like as well.
But then the stuff we already knew how to do kind of filtered through that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll hit on Lifetime again a little bit later, but putting the focus on Kid Dynamite now, it seemed from my impression, and I mean, I got to see you guys probably at least, you know, 6 or 7 times throughout the the times that you guys were hitting the road and touring a lot, it seems like that was definitely the most, focused, I guess, and, going for it, that you had ever been with a band as far as, the touring aspect and putting out records and, being part of the music industry, as it were. Did you feel, I'm guessing in some sense there was, pressure once the band had started and started to get momentum. Was that difficult for you to kind of navigate that type of pressure? And that's ultimately what led to, you guys pulling the plug with it? Or was that, other factors that obviously led to the band not being able to continue on?
I mean, for me, the pressure was internal.
Okay.
I felt like Lifetime was like reaching, there's like a certain velocity that an airplane taking off has to reach before the lift kind of takes hold of the wing. Mm-hmm. And I felt like Lifetime was just getting to that point. And then the rug was pulled out from under us. From my experience was the rug was pulled out from under me. And so I was like, wait, no. Yeah. I'm going to do is, even though I'm starting over, I'm going to the greatest extent possible, pick up where I left off.
Right.
So there's a lot of self-imposed pressure. Like, very focused on like what the band was going to sound like, what it wasn't going to sound like, and getting, making a record and getting on the road.
Right. And it did seem, I mean, just from the outside too, it did seem that way where you were, obviously there's, the straight line that you can draw between, Lifetime and Kid Dynamite, sonically, of course, different bands, but just the intentionality that you seem to approach that band with, where it's like, okay, I've learned a lot from being in Lifetime and being able to, do this, but then now Kid Dynamite is a more refined version of it from just, being able to get out there.
Yeah. And I think ultimately you talk about pressure. I think ultimately we didn't pull the plug. I think Jason pulled the plug and I think Dave and I put too much pressure on him.
Mm-hmm. True.
Dave and I were full on, we're going to do this, tour as much as possible. And I think we put too much pressure on Jason to live that.
Right.
We're naive. We thought, I think because that was what we laid out to anybody that was interested in trying out for vocals, we were like, this is what it's going to be. This is what we're going to do. And I think we're naive in thinking okay, well, so anyone who joins, that's what they're signing on for. And that's what they want to do. But it's one thing to talk about being on the road 6 months a year. It's another thing to be on the road 6 months a year.
Right. In practice. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not for everybody. It's emotionally and physically difficult.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And hitting on Paint It Black, just because that was obviously a departure for you being able to, put down the guitar and obviously pick up the microphone. It seemed to me that band existed in kind of a perfect stasis where, you started to personally, obviously develop a family and develop your practice and, be more settled and not being on the road for as much as you have been. Did you feel more balance with that band? Or was it, just as chaotic because you were having to balance all these other things that you were doing in your life?
More balanced because I think that we were not pushing ourselves, so it wasn't designed to be something that was all in 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure was really liberating because then you could at least be focused on on a more project by project basis where it's hey, here's I want to put out an EP. I want to put out a full length. Those were the things that you were marking the band as opposed to we have this tour coming up in 4 months and that's what we're preparing for.
Yeah. It was about making music not about touring really.
Sure. And did singing, I know you obviously did it in Lifetime as well. And this is sort of a hacky cliched question, but just the ability to transition into being comfortable in front of people with a microphone and kind of having that, you know, lead vocalist energy, as it were. Was that something that you felt like you had to kind of either learn or relearn as you did that with Paint It Black?
Yeah, I think it's really different with the microphone than with the guitar. You're a lot more exposed.
Right.
But it's also, you know, I think more physically taxing.
Definitely. Yeah. You have to, I mean, just that idea of, especially when you're, you know, playing in a punk or hardcore band and the sing-alongs come in and obviously people are jumping on your back, and like even removing that, it's still, you know, you're putting yourself out there in ways that you're literally exposed.
Yeah. Screaming for half an hour, like, especially at that pace, like sort of the way I think of like hardcore vocals should be, is like, it's rapid fire. It's like, delivery is like Ian MacKaye, Kevin Seconds, HR. And then, you know, so it's a lot of syllables, not a lot of space.
Right.
And
didn't have time to breathe necessarily.
Yeah. And like, I had a good, I knew how to scream, but like, I didn't know how to scream that fast for that long.
Let us talk about our friends at evilgreed.net. They are an amazing web store solutions provider for record labels and bands. But the thing is you as the consumer can order from them. Obviously, you understand how websites work. But what makes Evil Greed so cool is they act like a record label, where they have a very specific focus on the types of bands and labels that they are working with. But before I tell you more about them, you have to use this promo code. So go to evilgreed.net, use the promo code 100words. It gets you 10% off of your entire order. And let me just list some of their best sellers, their recent best sellers, to give you an idea of the type of stuff that we're talking about. How about a Terror Underdogs t-shirt? Or how about a Thou Feminism in Action t-shirt? How about the reissue of the Def Heaven Sunbather 10th anniversary? Oh my gosh. Or how about Isis, the band, the Mosquito Control, and Red Sea double LP? Oh my gosh. They have such cool stuff. Tsunami, Incendiary, Snuffed Out, Mutoid Man. You get it. They basically travel in all of the cool, heavy stuff that you most likely are into if you are listening to this show. And that is obviously why they enjoy working with this podcast and I enjoy working with them. It's a mutually beneficial relationship. They are based in Berlin, Germany, but do not let that scare you. You can get your order in and it ships at a very economical rate. And on top of it, it gets to you relatively quickly. I mean, we're not talking like, you know, Amazon Prime overnight or anything like that, but it gets to you. Honestly, I ordered from them before. Took about a week to a week and a half to get to me, which is amazing. So evilgreed.net, 100 words is the promo code. Please use that and enjoy buying all of the vinyl and t-shirts and stuff that you want. So there you go. Evilgreed.net. We love you.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day, whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade. At the Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97, for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at homedepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See homedepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot. How doers get more done.
It also struck me too with just the, you know, your output musically over the years, and, you know, people obviously kind of know what they're getting into when, you know, Dan starts a new project or a new band or what have you. But you definitely have removed so much, if not all, of like the ego that sometimes gets attached to bands and band members, where it's just like, oh yeah, you know, Dan Yeman, larger than life, like this, you know, Philly hardcore legend or whatever. And you have done everything you can personally to probably, you know, shed any of that, and have people place those expectations on you. Was that something that just obviously came pretty naturally for you to be like, listen, like I'm not that cool. Like just because I play in a band, like that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky and persistent. That's like the only thing I am. Okay. I'm not like, I think I'm a good songwriter, but like, I'm not a good guitar player. I'm not a, overall a great front man. I'm just like a kid who didn't want to stop.
Sure. Like, I'm going to stick around. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. I just want to keep making music and like, also, I think punk hierarchy is bullshit.
Yeah.
Like the idea that there's people you can't approach is obnoxious. Sure. Like a few times in my life, we opened for bands that didn't get off their tour bus until it was time to play. And right. That's that nonsense leaves such a bad taste in my mouth.
Sure. Especially because it's like, in direct opposition to everything that we've all collectively experienced as far as what this scene was, you know, built on, just the idea of, yeah, there's a stage, but like there's no separation between a band and an audience. Like everybody is in it. We just happen to have instruments in our hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why I still hate playing with barricades, no matter how much. At some point we do it occasionally, but at some point we started, and I don't mean just like all the bands, at some point it became more of like I'd rather make less money and play in a smaller stage without a barricade than like get paid a lot of money to play a festival. It's like flattering to be asked. And I know it's a position of privilege to turn that stuff down, but like, there's nothing more painful for me than playing with a barricade.
Right.
I mean, there are more painful things in my life, but like nothing more painful for me in the world of like in my creative world.
Yeah, of course. And on that somewhat related topic, the idea that, I mean, you've spoken about and articulated in past interviews how you've always been really thankful that you've never had to rely on your music and the bands that you've played in to, you know, make a living. And I know that that's something that, you know, some people like, they like that idea, but then they get caught up in, you know, the music industry as it were, and then kind of, you know, step on that treadmill. When did you kind of like arrive at that conclusion? Was that something that was like, even, you know, during the days of Kid Dynamite, where you guys were ostensibly, you know, making a living off of music, which, you know, just meant paying the rent from the guarantees?
Yeah.
When did you feel like you kind of, I guess, settled in that spot?
I guess like, probably, you know, somewhere between the end of Kid Dynamite and the beginning of Paint It Black.
Okay. It was just real, I guess, like you arrived there logically just based off of your previous experience and understanding like, oh, I can't, you know, I want to keep showing up, but I don't want to keep showing up in this way.
Yeah. And you know, like there's not that many people that can make that work also without destroying their like home life.
Sure. Which it always seemed to me too, that there was like, that was something that was clearly important to you, not only developing your career, but then, you know, having a family and everything like that. And I know some people, especially when you're talking about, you know, people in their late teens, early 20s, there's just like, oh, like the pinnacle of success is, you know, just touring all the time and like not having any other focus in your life. It's like, why are you doing this? Did people, I guess, treat you quizzically because of the fact that you wanted to have these other pursuits outside of, you know, just playing in a band, so to speak?
Yeah, definitely. It was a factor. Like, the factor in lifetime, definitely. Even though, like, I was on that path the whole time. I mean, when we started the band, I was out of college and studying for the GREs, like the graduate school, like entrance exams. So that was like always the thing I was pursuing, alongside everything else. And, you know, but sometimes somehow people would still be surprised that I was like, oh, I can't do this because I've got school obligations or whatever.
Right. They're like, what do you mean, Dan?
Like, it's amazing that I thought when I started grad school, it was like the Lifetime only had like Seven Inch and the Background LP out. And I was like, oh, well, I'm going to go to grad school. I'll have to stop playing in a band because, you know, I won't have time. And then, you know, it pretty quickly became apparent that that wasn't going to happen. Right. And then actually, like, the busier I was, the more productive I was.
Right. That's interesting, because that's what I was going to say, is the idea that, like, when you have the space to do both, like, you know, be creative, play in a band, but then also the space to be able to pursue, you know, a career, psychology, like, obviously all of those things that you're doing in your life, they probably fed one another in many respects.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. And I've also admired the fact that, you know, you've clearly been open about like your life in general, as far as like, oh yes, you know, like I am a, you know, psychologist or psychiatrist? I always
psychologist.
Okay. You've been open about that and bringing, you know, aspects of that to your lyrics, and whether it was in Paint It Black or anything else that you were doing from a musical perspective. And I don't know if this is like an ego thing, but a lot of people in punk and hardcore don't necessarily like to talk about their professional life, whether it's because they're embarrassed because they're working for, you know, the man or whatever, or if it's some other reason. Have you encountered that, or do you recognize that in, you know, kind of other people, or is that just, you know, me reading too much into things?
I don't know. I don't really think about much about how other people are doing it or not doing it, to be honest with you.
Sure.
I think that it's always just made sense to me to be, you know, within reason, open about who I am, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's like a total cliched saying, but just the idea of, you know, bring your whole self to work, where it's like, oh yes, like, you know, clearly you're not going to cover up who you are and the fact that you, you know, play in bands to your patients, and then vice versa, where the fact that you would speak about, you know, elements of your life outside of you just obviously singing in a band.
Yeah, I don't know how to talk around that. And also, like, how boring would this interview be if I just talked about, like, the band?
Totally. Totally. And especially too, and I'm sure you recognize this with your peers, where when, if you don't really have anything going on in your own personal life to be able to creatively inspire you, like, you're just going to end up, you know, writing either really cliched music or cliched lyrics or whatever, because you're not actually pulling inspiration from anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to pull inspiration from everything.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I agree. The stuff that you're doing with Open City seems to exist very much in the same space as where, you know, Paint It Black is, where you are just excited to play with these people, and everybody is, you know, clearly an adult and has a lot of experience playing in other bands and everything like that. I like the idea that you know, get together with the band to rehearse and practice, you know, once a week in the same way that a person would be like, all right, I got to play golf once a week or, you know, go to the bar on Friday night to like decompress. Is that basically just a function of like your own mental well-being where it's like, yeah, I got to have practice once a week because that helps.
Let me think.
Yeah.
I think when I'm not doing music regularly, it is like, I feel this sadness. And also the other thing is that, you know, when I'm in a really fertile creative period and I'm just writing a lot, like I might be playing my instrument a lot, but when I'm not writing, I can, like, if I am not accountable to people to show up at practice, I might not pick up my instrument for 2 months. It's like sitting on a stand, right? I'm looking at it right now in a corner of my living room. And I, you know, I get home from work. I have dinner with my family. I clean the kitchen. We walk the dog. I read to my kids, and then it's like time to go to sleep. So, if I don't have to be on point for something, I might not play for a while. I might really, and at this point, like my whatever skills I have can atrophy if I don't play regularly.
Sure. Sure.
The funny thing is, like you're talking about what you know of Open City from whenever I talked about it last, but subsequent to that, Open City is no longer a band that practices every week because Andy lives in California now.
Right.
So it was originally like Paint It Black. So Jared moved to California the same year my daughter was born. And so, you know, Paint It Black became a much more sporadic undertaking. And I was talking to Andy, I'm like, we need to do a band where everyone's here and we practice like a real band every week.
Right.
And that was like the premise before we even like really talked about what it would sound like. We just like wanted to be in a working band.
Sure.
But you know, circumstances change.
Right. And then now you have to be across the country and be like, all right, yeah. Well now obviously that means you have to start another band, Dan. I'm just kidding.
Well, I did join another band during the pandemic. Because I missed playing every week. I mean, they're my friends and I like their music, but I missed playing every week.
Sure, sure.
And I kind of was scared of what would happen to me as a musician if I wasn't playing every week.
Yeah, no, the awareness of that definitely makes sense just from the, like you said, the atrophying of the skill and be like, yeah. Dude, I haven't picked up my guitar in 6 months. And like, I can't even play any of this stuff.
Yeah.
It seems also too that with your involvement in, you know, the punk and hardcore scene and putting out records, it seems like now because you're, I mean, obviously, by all stretches of the definition, like you should be, you know, aging out of this. Like you shouldn't be, you know, caring about this at all and playing in bands. Like that's, you know, a young person's game or whatever. But it seems like, you know, with your choice to work with, like, get better records and still be exposing yourself to, you know, people under the age of 30 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that a function of why you are putting yourself out there and like putting in a record and Get Better or whatever? Like you could have obviously just done, you know, something else, but is that kind of a goal of Open City or any of your other future music projects to, you know, be able to get in front of younger people?
No, I think it's inevitable if you're making this kind of music.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think about age much when I think about this thing. I just think about people that are like passionate about passionate about music and ideas and about stuff that is not, doesn't, you know, fit easily into mainstream categories and doesn't rely on like mainstream business structures and all the mess that comes with that in order to sort of thrive.
Right. The last two things I want to hit on was the idea that I find the Lifetime self-titled LP was so interesting because it, you know, I mean, talk about a random thing that I think many people didn't anticipate was like new music from Lifetime as you guys started to play again. And then especially the, you know, Fall Out Boy, Fueled by Ramen connection and all that sort of stuff. And it seemed like there was essentially like almost the biggest platform that any of your bands had with that particular connection. Was the process of putting that music together and putting that record together, you know, any different? Not like you were like, all right, we're going to write the hits, you know, here's some singles or whatever. But, you know, did you approach it differently just based off of, you know, age and circumstance? Or was it kind of basically like all the other times that you had, you know, pen stuff with Lifetime?
I mean, it was only approached differently because our life circumstances were different. In fact, we were really deliberate about trying to make it under as similar circumstances as possible as we made the record before it 10 years earlier. So even though none of us lived in New Brunswick anymore, we wrote it there. And, you know, all kind of commuted different stupid distances to meet there. And we recorded it in the same studio with the same person as we did all our other records.
Sure.
And we didn't want it to sound like a departure. We just wanted to sound like the next thing after the last thing.
Right. The logical extension.
Yeah. And I think the only thing that was different was because we had all started to have families, and so we had less time. And I think that some of the only thing that was maybe missing was that I think we wrote some of our best stuff in the mid and late 90s. Dave and Ari lived together in an apartment with a bunch of our friends. And then later on in a house where there were a lot of shows and stuff going on. And so we would like do stuff at practice and they would keep working on it at home. And some real magical stuff happened as a result of that. And we couldn't approximate that.
Right.
The way our lives were in 2007.
Right. The fine tuning couldn't happen after the fact. So yeah, that makes sense.
But we were a lot better at being in Lifetime 10 years later. So like after having had a lot of time not being in Lifetime and doing other stuff. So like the time we had together was extremely productive and fertile.
Right. Yeah. You guys, as they say, you guys knew the assignment and everybody was showing up, you know, ready to get things done, so to speak.
Yeah. But it was I think it was a great decision to have it be geographically like.
Yeah, absolutely.
True to the original sort of the original process, I guess.
Yeah, sure. The last thing I want to hit is the fact that, I mean, you know, your kids are obviously of an age where they have most likely interacted with your music and or, you know, have opinions about it. You know, do they feel like this is a, I mean, obviously you're just dad and they don't necessarily, you know, think one way or another per se, but how do they, you know, interact with your music? Do they think it's like, oh, that's funny. Dad's in a band and dad does these things. How does that kind of interact with your kids?
They think it's cool.
Nice.
But it's like, you know, it's always been a part of the landscape. So, it's not like, I don't know if it's a big deal for them.
Right.
They, but you know, my kids are into music, so they're not really into yelly music as they would call it, but they like,
sure.
Appreciate my older child is a musician also. And she very much appreciates like on a musical level.
Sure. Sure. Have they seen you play?
They have, but not much.
Sure.
They have seen me play. Hopefully more now that they can stay up a little later.
Right, exactly.
Like I think when we do record release shows for this stuff coming out in the fall, I want to make sure they're there.
Oh boy, that was Mr. Dan Yemin. Thank you very much to Alex at Get Better Records for hooking this interview up, and check out all of his new music that he has coming out, New Paint of Black, New Open City. It's really great stuff. So if you are in the New England area and you happen to be going to the New England Metal and Hardcore Festival, I'll be there this weekend. So, you know, say what's up. I would always like to, you know, meet people who are listening to this show. I'm recording some podcasts out there, which I am very excited about, and it will be a fun time because I finally get to visit my very good friend's record store, Joey Cahill, a honorary guest of the show, his store called Wanna Hear It Records, and I'm incredibly excited about that. And yeah, it's always fun. But next week, oh man, I am celebrating the 11th year of this show existing, which is absolutely incredible to say, and it feels even weirder to hear my words echo back to me. But I have a banger of an episode. I have Nick Hexum from 311. And I know what you're thinking. You're like, wait, what does this dude have to do with like punk or hardcore? Let me just tell you this. 311's first show was with Fugazi. Nick and the 311 people definitely know what is up with DIY. They really did it. You know, they, even though musically they might not sound anything like the bands that, you know, we were kind of raised on, so to speak. But, yeah, they, by all stretch of the imagination, they are a punk band as far as I'm concerned. So anyways, that's what we got next week. 11th anniversary, Nick Hexum from 311. So here we go. And until then, please be safe, everybody. The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Zero Foxtrot isn't just a brand. It's a way of life. Founded and operated by veterans, Zero Foxtrot's unique apparel and gear echoes the grit of the warrior culture. Zero Foxtrot dedicates itself to producing content, honoring the sacrifices of forgotten heroes of the past, and connecting history to the present. Embark on a journey with Zero Foxtrot today at ZeroFoxtrot.com. It's not merely our products. It's about the ethos that we embody. Rugged, resilient, and timeless.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.